7:08 in the morning here on Upfront. I'm Kat Brooks.
And I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert. We're going to start our show with those international talks Eileen made reference to in the news headlines, indirect talks kicking off in Vienna in an effort to reinstate some form of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal that the Trump administration withdrew from in May of 2018. These will be indirect talks. Negotiators for the U.S. and Iran will not be in the same room at the same time, at least in first. At first, their proposals will move through other powers, the European Union, Russia, and China. The basic trade-off here is that once the U.S. pulled out, it reinstated sanctions that had been in place on Iran before the deal and added new sanctions. Iran would like those gone. Iran started enriching uranium and stockpiling enriched uranium at rates that were not allowed by the deal. And more recently has started restricting access of inspectors to some of its sites. The U.S. would like to see it operating back under the terms of the deal. There could be a lot more in terms of demands going into the talk, so we'd start by catching you up on the lay of the land. We're joined now by Jamal Abdi, president of the National Iranian American Council, or NIAC. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on the show. Why don't you start with kind of the basics? Once Donald Trump kind of, you know, very theatrically pulled the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal, what did Iran start doing differently?
So, interestingly, Iran really demonstrated some serious restraint when Donald Trump initially withdrew, which, you know, I think is really telling in a departure from, you know, the perception of where Iran has been on this issue and other issues. When Donald Trump exited the deal in 2018, Iran actually continued to abide by it, you know, to a T. And it wasn't until the 1 year anniversary of Donald Trump's exit that Iran began remedial measures. So they began to actually breach elements of the deal. So you know, lifting certain caps on its nuclear program and its research and development. And really, it did this in a telegraphed way with a message that, you know, this is in response to the sanctions and the fact that Iran was not actually receiving the benefits of the deal because the United States had pulled out and not just slapped its own sanctions on, but also threatened to sanction other countries who went into Iran. And so over the past, you know, a little over a year or so, Iran has been committing these breaches so that today Iran is effectively, you know, on the brink of where it was before the nuclear deal was ever put into place. If you look at, you know, a chart of Iran's, you know, centrifuges or its, you know, the amount of uranium, enriched uranium that it has, you see that number drop off as soon as the deal came into place in 2015 and 2016. And then as soon as Iran started breaching the deal in response to Donald Trump, those numbers started to grow again. And now we're back, not quite to where we were, but close to this crisis point where Iran is within, you know, a couple of months of having the capability to, you know, break out and develop a nuclear weapon without being detected.
Meanwhile, the U.S. not only reinstated the sanctions that preceded the deal, but imposed new ones under Donald Trump. Can you walk us through what they have been, what impact they've had inside Iran?
Yeah, so when Donald Trump exited the deal, he put in place a policy that was, as you said, theatrically presented, as with most things with Donald Trump, and it was called maximum pressure. And the idea here was that every opportunity to constrain economic activity or impose any kind of pressure on Iran, those opportunities would be taken. And in some cases, that didn't just mean sanctions, that meant other measures such as little things like restricting the movement of Iranian diplomats at the United Nations or barring visas for Iranian diplomats. But then, you know, more broadly, what we saw was, you know, inside of Iran, sort of massive economic impact. Every major Iranian bank is under sanctions. The Iranian economy suffered badly. Their oil exports plummeted. And, you know, really, we hear from ordinary people inside of Iran who are just really struggling to make ends meet. And you know, the Iranian economy, it was already in a bad state. The deal, when it was put into place and the sanctions were lifted, the Iranian economy started to recover, but never really fully. And the sanctions relief never really fully went into place. It was never felt inside of Iran because these things take time. It takes time to unravel a sanctions regime and to encourage companies to move in. So Iran never really saw the benefit of the deal. And inside of Iran, you know, when the deal was first signed, there were videos of Iranians, you know, in Tehran in the streets celebrating and thinking that this was this big turning point, both for, you know, for Iran's economy and day to day living, but also Iran's role in the world and relationships with other countries and, you know, ability to be more of a normal player. And that never came to fruition because shortly thereafter, Donald Trump came to office, and while he didn't abandon the deal, he began threatening to tear it up. And this then, you know, convinces banks and private companies not to take the risk of going into Iran because the rug could be pulled out from under you if the deal or if the sanctions come back into place. And so now we're in a position where Iran, you know, has suffered economically. Ordinary people have suffered, especially during the coronavirus pandemic, access to medical devices, medical goods. Has been constrained by the sanctions. But, you know, others say that the Iranian economy has sort of withstood the worst of the U.S. pressure and is now on a path to recovery. And so I think that there is a sense that while things are very bad for ordinary Iranians, while ordinary Iranians themselves who were so supportive of the deal now view the deal as a failure, and there's a kind of lack of trust that the United States would ever make good on the terms of a negotiated agreement. But if that economic pressure is actually lessening now and Iran is able to withstand this pressure, the notion of the United States having more leverage thanks to these sanctions is actually in dispute. And I think that Iranian urgency to get back in the deal is not quite as high as maybe some had thought it would be coming into the situation where there was going to be a potential, you know, negotiation to get back into the deal. And so I think both sides need to understand the chips that they have may not be quite as strong as they thought.
Yeah. Talk about what it's done to politics inside Iran. There's elections this June. The nuclear deal itself was kind of a signature achievement of the reformist wing of Iranian politics that mm-hmm. brought the current president Hassan Rouhani into government.
Yeah, and I think this is actually, in my mind, this is the most important factor. And I think, you know, many in Washington may disagree, but, you know, we have to go back to 2013 when this new Iranian president Hassan Rouhani is elected, defying the expectations of most observers, because this is somebody not favored by the supreme leader. And this was the first election after the disputed 2009 presidential elections, which saw massive protests. The opposition leader, who many thought won that election, was put under house arrest. And then in 2013, you see a lot of those same forces who mobilized around that green movement and to challenge that election. Instead of protesting and sitting back at home, they actually all showed up to the ballots and voted for Rouhani, whose campaign was very much premised on, you know, internal change and external moderation and, you know, engaging with the West and finally, you know, having serious negotiations and resolving those challenges and having Iran be more integrated in the world. And so this was a win, I think, for democratic forces in Iran and the Iranian people to elect this guy into office in 2013. And for the first time, we actually had a president in Iran and a president in the United States who were on the same page about the need to get to the negotiating table and who wanted to change the direction of the relationship and kind of fundamentally shift things. And that's, you know, that's how we get the nuclear deal. There were other, you know, players in Iran who were, you know, involved, and there were talks before Rouhani took office. But really, it was that political mandate delivered by the Iranian people that set us on this pathway for diplomacy. And that's why it's been so damaging to have Donald Trump come in and renege on that agreement, because so much of Iran's political future and this coalition was staked on the notion that Iran could engage with the United States and find, you know, mutually beneficial arrangements to proceed with. And I think that, you know, myself included, believe that, you know, if you resolve the tensions with the United States, you resolve, you know, the outside threat of war, the pressure that sanctions puts on, you know, the middle class and activists who are sort of central to any movement for progressive change inside of Iran. And by coming out of the deal, we kind of, you know, kneecapped all of those efforts. And now you see an Iranian population where, you know, whereas Rouhani and his coalition were winning elections since 2013 and post-nuclear deal, overwhelmingly, and had this kind of overwhelming popular support to really bring change to Iran. And now, just, you know, a couple of years after Donald Trump exits the deal, you have Iranians, you know, the turnout to Iranian elections. They had a parliamentary election last year, and it was, you know, lowest turnout in history. People are completely disillusioned. And while, you know, the elections are by no means free or fair, they are an opportunity for the people to have an impact on things. And now people are disengaged. The fear is now that going into this next presidential election, rather than having somebody win on a mandate of engaging the West, you may have somebody win based on a mandate of standing up to the West, of being more confrontational. And you're probably going to see an Iranian electorate that is very disengaged and kind of allows this to move forward. And it's very similar to what we saw in 2005, when after a number of fits and starts where you had a reformist Iranian administration seeking negotiations with the West, seeking accommodation, and that led nowhere and sort of ushered in the rise of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who was campaigning on this notion of, you know, these other guys were wimps, I'm going to resist the West, I'm going to stand up to them. And that, combined with an electorate that was disillusioned at the time, that didn't show up to the ballot box, gave us this hardliner who you know, I think set the potential for resolving U.S.-Iran tensions significantly back. And the fear is, you know, we're so close to reviving the JCPOA, but if you don't have that in place and you have the Iranian election, you know, it's likely that a hardliner is going to come into place, and then the possibility of getting back to the table of getting a negotiated solution to any of these challenges becomes even more distant.
I'll translate the acronym. That's the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. That's what the Iran nuclear deal is technically called. We're speaking to Jamal Abdi, president of NIAC, the National Iranian American Council. The occasion is the kickoff to indirect talks over reinstating some version of the Iran nuclear deal. They are starting today in Vienna. They are indirect because the U.S. and Iran, principal parties to the deal, will not actually be meeting with each other in the same room. They will be, at least initially, passing overtures and proposals through third-party entities, the European Union, Russia, and China. Let's talk about what those politics do to the negotiating room of the Iranian government. Like, obviously, it would strengthen President Rouhani's hand going into these June elections. He's not up for re-election, but, you know, his reformist coalition is fronting a candidate. To have some kind of deal reinstated, that probably means a lot of hardliners in Iranian politics would tank it. How much power do they actually have? Who does he have to convince within Iran's political system that a deal is worth pursuing?
Well, first and foremost, the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, does have to, you know, at least give the signal that he's okay with this. Now, the way that he often operates is he's got these different factions. He's got, you know, the reformist faction, and really Rouhani is part of a reformist and moderate faction. So it's not quite as challenging to the system. But, you know, you've got them, you've got the more conservatives, you've got the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, which, is a military that was set up under the revolution, that is very loyal to the Supreme Leader, and that has become kind of a not just military but economic power base inside of Iran and a political power base, and that's going to be the faction that, you know, they benefit from Iran's isolation from the rest of the world. They benefit from the sanctions that enables smuggling business, and for you need to be connected to the state in order to benefit in the current economy. And so they are going to, I think, be looking to scuttle any deal. Not too unsimilar from what we're going to see in the United States with, you know, certainly Republicans on the Hill and some of the more hawkish groups are going to be trying to play the role of spoiler. I think for Iran, the concern is, you know, even around the nuclear deal, you saw these spoiler activities inside of Iran. You saw the detention of U.S. dual nationals. You saw after the deal was signed, you know, sort of provocative military displays, ballistic missiles paraded with anti-Israel messages and things like that. And those are, you know, those are the ways that these other players can undermine Rouhani and kind of give the opponents in the West fodder to be able to marshal their own opposition to an agreement. So, you know, it's incredibly fraught. It always is fraught with Iran. You know, there are these massive divisions, and, you know, despite Iran not being a democracy, there is serious competition among these different political factions. And so now, close to an election, I mean, I think that the understanding is that once we get into, you know, May, it's going to be increasingly difficult for Rouhani to really, you know, bring any big policies home, because then you're going to have various actors jockeying in the elections. And so that fraught nature of Iran's politics and those divisions, I think, are going to be even more pronounced, which is why, you know, the hope is to get this done quickly. And even now, it feels like we may be just a couple weeks late from where we needed to be in order to get this wrapped up in time to not be subsumed by the election and the efforts of certain people to spoil a potential resolution.
I'm curious what you think of the public signals from the Biden administration about their negotiating posture. They've been very clear that they are pushing for any new agreement to go further, at least on timelines. They want the sunsets for some of the enrichment restrictions to extend further than they did under the original deal. But I was just reading the transcript of an interview that one of the U.S. negotiating team members, Robert Mallory, did with NPR this morning. And he kind of demurred when he was pressed on whether the U.S. would be pushing for anything regarding Iran's ballistic missiles program or its support for other actors in the region, like Houthi rebels in Yemen or Hezbollah.
Yeah, and this is really crucial, you know. The Biden team was, frankly, I think that they fumbled a bit out of the gate with their messaging. The position of the Biden administration had been going into November, the elections, and has been to return to the original Iran nuclear agreement, to return to the JCPOA as it was originally constituted. Anybody who was involved with those talks understands that, you know, that it took years to get that agreement in place. And any effort to renegotiate an agreement, anybody on our side, on the U.S. side, who's saying we want more from the Iranians, has a counterpart on the Iranian side who's saying, well, we want more from the Americans. We didn't like the original deal. It didn't do enough for us. Nobody's saying we want more from the other side, so we're going to come in and find a way to compromise. I don't think the political space exists for a bigger deal at this point in time. And I think that the Biden team understands that. I think that they were maybe a bit sloppy with their messaging and allowed for there to be a conflation between going back to this deal and building on this deal for a follow-on agreement. And I think that's where you start to get into the more tricky issues like ballistic missiles, like Iran's support for regional proxies, and issues that, you know, I don't know that there is a light at the end of the tunnel on. They're going to be very tricky. I think Yemen actually may be an area where once a JCPOA is in place so that, you know, the sides can talk, then you might actually have an opportunity for regional dialogue on Yemen to be able to resolve that challenge. But for now, the sequencing is so important. And all of this is premised on, and the reason that Iran is not directly talking to the United States is that there is already a deal in place. Iran is still a party to the deal. Even though they, you know, have committed these breaches, they are still formally in the deal. The United States is not in the deal. And so when the Trump administration was saying, you know, we're imposing sanctions to get Iran back to the table, we want a bigger and better deal, Iran was saying, well, we're already at the table. The table is the JCPOA. The table is the nuclear deal. And until you're back at that table, we're not going to talk to you about other things at other tables. So first things first, get back to the JCPOA. It should not be you know, as complicated as I think some have made it out to be. I think some who maybe have an interest in dragging this out a little bit longer than it needs to be, get back into the JCPOA, and then from there, you build on that agreement to address these other issues. And that includes the issues that the U.S. wants to dialogue on. I think also the idea is inside of Iran, advocates for you know, democracy and human rights, they can also build on this platform of reduced tensions in order to address these things. But this is a long challenge. It's not going to be resolved in one single negotiation. And that's why it's so important that we pocket the deal that we already had and we use that as the launch pad for future talks instead of trying to start from scratch, which is just not tenable at this point in time. And it's, I think it's going to lead to disaster if that's where we end up going.
Jamal Abdi, I'm sorry to press you with time being short, but doesn't the fact that some of the provisions of the original nuclear deal sunset mean that the passage of time is mooting them? I mean, doesn't it have to be something different if it's going to actually be applicable?
Well, you know, most of the deal is permanent. And there's been a lot made about some of these sunsets. The sunsets, first of all, we still have a number of years before those come into place. Second of all, things like the inspections, you know, the total inspections of all the nuclear facilities inside of Iran, the eyes and the ears on the program, that doesn't go away. Now, there are sunsets on things like, you know, UN sanctions on Iranian arms trade, which actually that sunset has already expired. And the Trump administration was unable to prevent those sanctions from being lifted at the UN because they weren't in the deal, so on and so forth. So I think the point is, you get in the deal now, you get those permanent benefits, you get the permanent inspections. Some of the things that will sunset, those can be negotiated, but they have to be negotiated from within the deal rather than from outside of the deal. Otherwise, they're not going to go anywhere.
All right. Jamal Abdi, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.